Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom.
Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Blinn, joined by the boss, John Roering, Craig Mauger, Jacob Kanzler, and Lauren Gibbons. A little later, Tony Daunt from the Freedom Fund is going to be joining us. But first, we really got to address the Flint situation. Again, to kick off the podcast, the Detroit Free Press took a hammer and knife to the governor, I think, over the weekend. And now even Hillary Clinton is getting involved in the action, banging on the governor and the administration. This isn't getting good. Craig, is this really the low point, you think, of the Snyder administration?
I believe yes. Just from looking at it as an outsider, I think it is. I mean, this is a governor who has received mostly positive media attention from the national media. And this is really the first time the national media is really going after him and not holding back. You've got the state's largest newspapers writing editorials against him. It's really quite a situation. And I think the biggest thing is, in the Flint water, what's going on in Flint, what's the resolution there? How does that resolve itself? How does the governor fix that? It's nothing that can be fixed. What's happening in Detroit with Detroit Public Schools? Schools are closing. Kids aren't getting to go to class because of what's going on there. How does that situation resolve itself? It's going to be a really interesting year for him.
Yeah, he makes him wonder if he really wanted that second term after all. Jacob, what does he do? I mean, is there anything that can be done? Because whatever he's doing right now doesn't seem to be catching hold, whether it's the state police hand-delivering filters or water bottles or what?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, the governor's office and the administration is trying to do everything it can to show that they're taking it seriously, because I think the big knock against them, among other things, is maybe not taking it as seriously earlier in the year. So it's going to be interesting to see kind of what satisfies the people that are the angriest. I mean, there's a lot of justifiable anger in Flint and people that represent Flint. So it's a question of what needs to happen, what action needs to be taken to show that the state is working towards a solution or a solution is made.
You know, at a certain point, it seems like a general acknowledgement of what happened and a leadership, a willingness to take leadership on the issue is in call, because it seems like all last year it was kind of this drip, drip, drip thing. Oh, it's not that bad. Oh, it's not that bad. Oh, God, maybe it's worse than we thought. And it's kind of been snowballed into, oh, my God, this is really a big darn deal. And the response so far, Lauren, has been a little strange, like talking about, well, you've got lead poisoning. Maybe there's something you can do personally to fix it with diet or...
One of the points that's been put out there since, you know, the emergency was called and is that the diet and nutrition, some of the people that were hardest hit by this are the people who are in dire poverty, and they're already in food deserts or they're not able to get access to diet and nutrition needs. So really, it's a question of whether the administration is going to be able to put money where their mouth is and actually provide the resources that the people hardest hit by this issue will actually get what they need, which, you know, maybe the diet, nutrition, the water, you know, just there's so many things that need to be solved here that it's almost it'll be interesting to see how that plays out over this
year.
Wow,
the dollar figures just seem to grow here. You know, we have the whole issue of what, $1.5 billion possibly to replace the pipes there in Flint, because now they've been corroded to the point where they need to be replaced. Then we've got the human needs here about how do we take care of the people who have now had lead poisoning. And you bring up the point of, well, geez, they're poor and they can't afford, you know, to drive or get to a grocery store that actually has nutritious food because they're stuck, you know, near the local beer store or whatever and just getting snacks off the rack if they can afford that with their EBT cards. John, this could add up real quickly.
On a financial basis, it will add up very quickly, just the cost. And the thing is, when you think about the $1.5 billion for the Flint repair to their water system, you can multiply that across the state 10 times over when you think about the Detroit water system probably has some serious needs. Any older community has some serious needs. And infrastructure in terms of our sewer and water system is something that we really haven't even started to talk about as a society. We just had this huge debate about roads, but we have an enormously aging infrastructure when it comes to water. So there's a lot of money that could be added up and invested.
Craig, let's talk about this from the political angle here, too. This is something that the legislature probably should stop ignoring and maybe want to tackle head on as far as the Republican leadership. Would you agree with that?
I mean, they did take an action, a pretty small action last year, to do something to help Flint by allocating some money there. But it does seem that they need to get serious and do something big. And that's going to take finances. And I don't know how much money the state's going to have laying around to allocate money to Flint. I mean, they just invested a huge amount of future state dollars to roads. They have some budget problems coming up. Where's the money going to come from to fix this? And secondly, I mean, from a political standpoint, they have to do something. But this governor just invested a huge amount of political capital on the roads plan. How much does he have left to get lawmakers who are maybe not wanting to act on Detroit public schools to do something about Detroit and get them to do something about what's going on in Flint?
Well, the optics are you guys would admit, are starting to look pretty bad here. And the Republican-led legislature could get roped right into this just as easy as the governor has. Your state legislature, you can see the commercials now, John?
Well, think about it. Just take the whole Flint thing. This is what Republican government has given you. And you show these kids, and you talk about lead poisoning and developmental
challenges. And then you show the bottles of the dirty water.
Add that, though, also to the rhetoric you can bring about through 571 and the elimination of straight party ticket voting. And the emergency manager and the national attention this is getting. You could create a situation here where Democratic causes in Michigan become a huge funding cause across the nation for Democrats to sort of fix this regime that has given us Flint water, that has given us the elimination of straight party voting, that has given us all that is 571. It's just a timing issue, though. I mean, but I could see it actually happen.
In a mailer, this situation in Flint can be directly tied to the emergency manager law that so many Republicans have voted for and supported now twice over the last few years. And then also, as this Flint situation is really breaking out into a public health crisis, the legislature is not working on that. They're working on election reforms. The optics of that are pretty bad.
So, I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, this obviously now has become the state's number one issue, right? And so how does the Republican legislature deal with this? I mean, at some point, do they take the idea of Jim Ananick and it's time to have some kind of special committee? And do they even entertain the thought, if they go ahead and do that, maybe they'd want to entertain the thought of having a Democrat at least co-chair the thing. So just to erase the optics of politics and putting in its place the optics of wanting to actually do something. Let's put Sheldon Neely as a co-chair of something and have Tim Kelly or somebody from the area come in and kind of co-chair it with them to make it look like they're taking a leadership role to try and actually do something, because if not, they could get rolled in this snowball.
How they do not have hearings on this would be shocking. I mean, if they don't, that would be shocking to me. I mean, they just had how many hearings, how much investigative work, how much time spent on looking into the philandering and antics of two of Republican members. I mean, how much time was spent on that? You'd have to think that a similar amount of time should be warranted for what's going on in Flint.
Yeah, one of the key arguments that Democrats have been pushing here is this was a Democratic community and Republicans ignored it. They ignored it for a year. And so one of the best things the state could do from a Republican leadership perspective is, you know, show that they are willing to be bipartisan in this situation and show that they are willing to, you know, just willing to take this head on and willing to do whatever it takes to fix this problem, because otherwise, as many of you have mentioned, the optics will just not look great in this 2016 election.
We got to touch on Senate Bill 571 because the legislature has been talking about doing some clarifying language. So I'm going to ask the question, do they clarify it or do they end up just repealing it altogether?
I think they repeal what they enacted in terms of the limitations on local governments and public schools.
Right,
I
not repeal the whole thing.
I think what the rest of it's going to stand.
Right, exactly. We're just talking about the section about the 60-day ban on some type of communication.
I wouldn't be surprised if they repealed it and just returned it back to what it was before.
The leadership isn't inclined to go that route yet, Craig. That's fair
no,
to say.
No, I don't think they'll repeal that section of the bill. I think what's going to happen is there'll be some type of language put in a bill that says local government officials can talk about local ballot proposals as they see fit. But I think the ban on TV ads, radio ads, mailers, I think that's staying because there's support. Our interview guest, Tony Dunn, is going to speak out for that here in a few moments.
Yeah, because the Freedom Fund, for one, is going to want to do nothing, mm-hmm. right? Just leave it alone. There's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, I think a lot of Republican leadership is comfortable with the idea of the 60 days. They just want to make sure they clarify the intent of the language and ensure it's not going further than they wanted it to. So I don't see more than minor changes coming out of that. It wouldn't look great, from an outside perspective if, you know, all these people voted for this legislation and then all of a sudden, oh, well, we screwed up. Let's repeal it. I just don't see that happening.
The one thing we don't know is how much pressure local officials and school board members and school officials in general have put on individual Republican lawmakers. How much influence do they have on them? And when they go into the caucus room and they come back Wednesday, are they coming back saying, well, you know what, I got kind of beat up a little bit in my hometown, and if we go ahead and scrap it, I'm fine with that.
But is that an argument for going back and clarifying it? Or is that an argument from just rubbing your hands together and say, let's move on from this?
They have to take some kind of action, right? You would think. Well, maybe not.
Tony Dunn says no.
I guess it just kind of depends on what kind of impact the local arm twisting has had on these people.
My guess is there's been a fair amount of local arm twisting too. And one of the things we'll have to write about when they do come back to caucuses is what was the reaction, and we'll have a better sense then, I think, of the likelihood of moving something.
You know what I find interesting here is just not Democrats who have been outspoken in opposing this particular language in 571. The Tea Parties don't like this either, do they, Craig?
No, a lot of conservative Tea Party individuals have been speaking out against it because they see it as a freedom of speech issue. One of the other things that's interesting about this bill that I don't think the Tea Party has quite picked up on yet is that this piece about debt and how campaign debt can be handled is probably going to be something that hurts conservative grassroots candidates and Tea Party individuals pretty badly in future elections.
Well, explain this. How is that the case?
Because if you look at the way the districts are set up right now, a lot of districts that are Republican districts have one competitive race to fill them for three terms.
Basically, the primary.
The first primary when the seat is open is the expensive race for candidates. So under this bill, a Republican in a crowded field could run up and hit contribution limits from a whole bunch of contributors and then also go into debt himself in that first primary race. But then once he wins the seat, he can take contributions and use them to pay back himself from the same individuals that hit the contribution limits in that first race. So basically he has three cycles to pay back money that he put in himself that first time. So it could lead to more money in crowded Republican primary races.
And so what you're saying is that the Tea Party candidate typically is not someone who comes from a lot of money, mm-hmm. doesn't necessarily have a lot of access to money.
Yeah.
And so that the maybe the quote-unquote establishment candidate, whoever he or she may be, is just going to use personal wealth to basically rack up a little bit of debt just on the presumption that it will get paid back over time. Interesting. We kind of just saw that in the Cindy Gamrat seat, didn't we?
Yeah.
I mean, we've got a candidate who racked up an amazing amount of debt. She won, and now she's got, arguably, she's going to have 7 years to pay it back.
Yeah, and there could be, I'm not saying this will happen, but it's possible that they could say, don't worry, put the money in, you'll get that money back, the people who recruit these candidates. It's plausible.
Well, something to think about here, for sure. Joining us now for this section of the podcast, Tony Daunt. He's with the Freedom Fund. Thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Tell our listeners a little bit about the Freedom Fund. How long have you been around, and what is kind of your goal?
Sure. Freedom Fund started back in 2012. Genesis was the fight against Proposal 2 back then, which was the collective bargaining ballot initiative. And then the group transitioned into pushing for and advocating for the passage of the Freedom to Work or the Right to Work legislation. You know, I joined in 2013, so I wasn't around when those first couple of issues were hot and heavy. But in 13, I joined, and our focus has been on promoting good public policy, whether it be repealing the prevailing wage and protecting taxpayers and folks at the local government and school district level. Electric choice, House Bill 4298, we believe, and we've been very vocal since it was introduced, does a great deal of damage to the electric choice market, and we've been very vocal about pushing back on that. We want to protect that 10% at a bare minimum. We also believe in really anything that protects taxpayers, that protects ratepayers, that reduces the size and the intrusion of government.
So how much of the Freedom Fund is sponsored by the DeVos family or Dick DeVos?
You know, back in 2012 when the group was founded, the DeVos family had a large part to do with that, but there were also at the time there were hundreds of folks who supported us, whether that be financially, whether that be through social media engagement, sharing our message with their friends and their family. And we've grown considerably over the last 3.5 odd years that we've been in existence. You know, it's been 2.5 years since I've been there, and I've seen great growth in terms of who supports us, again, whether it be financially or whether it be through social media, through our email list, through folks who volunteer to help us with some of our projects. You know, it's certainly not just a DeVos family organization.
Okay, and you guys are what, a 501c4?
The Freedom Fund is a 501c4, yes.
Okay, yep. And it's just fair to say the DeVos's are still a contributor of the Freedom Fund.
The DeVos's are, you know, our backers. They are involved, but they are certainly not the only one. Sometimes it can be a little frustrating when we hear that we're just an arm of the DeVos family, because you've got groups like Progress Michigan. You know, it seems like they're never asked who their donors are, who their big funders are. We always get tagged with, the DeVos family Freedom Fund. And I think that's maybe a little bit of a double standard.
We've got a couple issues that you guys are really excited about. 571, Senate Bill 571. Let's talk about that. What was your guys' role in seeing that bill and its final version get signed into law?
We were very happy with that legislation when it came out of the House and the Senate, when it passed the legislature. We believed that the language in there related to prohibiting local units of government, whether they be townships or municipal cities or local school districts. We don't have any problem with anybody engaging in political speech, and whether that be to raise taxes, to lower taxes. We just ask that everybody play by the same rules. And we don't believe that local units of government should be using taxpayer dollars to engage in campaign activity. It's not a gag order. I think that the hyperbole and the real kind of ridiculous claims you've seen from some of these groups, like the librarians, that National Librarian Group, that claimed that folks are going to be tossed in jail, that's absurd. Number one, I don't think anybody's ever been thrown in jail for criminal activity related to the Michigan Campaign Finance Act. And if it has, you know, it's got to be years ago, because I don't recall anything since I've been around. That's, as we were just discussing, that's been quite a while, actually. You know, I think it shows that they are not comfortable arguing on the merits of what the legislation does. So they're making things up.
What do you make of the fact that no one knows where this language came from, first off? And do you think that supporters of this are at a disadvantage, that no one's come forward and said, yeah, I wanted this language in there and I'm proud of this?
Here in Lansing and, you know, within the square mile radius here of the Capitol, there's always this focus on process and how things came to be and who supports it, who opposes it. And we focus on what the policy is. And we simply believe that the policy was very well done, and we agree with it. And, you know, we don't think that there's a need for any kind of clarifying language. You know, we're going to be paying close attention to what the legislature does in regard to that, because, you know, we would hate to see something, you know, of this magnitude, something that's such good public policy, basically withdrawn or negated because of a kind of hot and heavy outcry by a few special interest groups.
Will the Freedom Fund advocate against clarification of this?
I think it's going to depend on what that language does. You know, we don't know what they're going to come up with. We don't know what it will say. We don't know how far they're going to go. And so we'll be keeping a close eye on it. And if we believe that it basically undoes what 571 does do in terms of prohibiting that campaign activity with tax dollars, then we will certainly speak vocally. We will speak loudly to the legislature and to our grassroots supporters to contact their legislators to let them know that this needs to stay in place.
So just to be clear, did the Freedom Fund have anything to do with 571?
We support the legislation as it was written and as it came out of legislature. We communicated with folks at the grassroots level, and we did some information. We did a couple of emails that said, you know, contact the governor, let him know that he needs to sign this. We support,
but you guys aren't taking owner. You're not taking ownership of this.
No, this as far as I know, my understanding of the process is LSB writes the legislation, and we support the policy and we want to see it stay in place.
You guys weren't there the night it got adopted, and you weren't working with members? And
I believe I was there at the Capitol, but I was just kind of monitoring everything that was going on. We were not meeting behind closed doors or anything like that. The process, again, the process is important to some of the folks, here in the Capitol, but to us, it's all about the policy.
Did you guys know that was in there before the vote happened?
I think that we were, expecting some good policy to come out of the legislature. And, anything that protects taxpayers, and we believe this does, we believe this protects taxpayers and stops campaign activity from local units of government, we were very happy with what the legislature did that night.
Talk a little bit about what you want to get done the rest of the year. What's your big agenda item?
I think first and foremost is continuing to protect the 10% electric choice market. The utilities have spent a great deal of time, money, and effort with the legislature, millions of dollars, whether it be through lobbying or through their public advocacy work, their television commercials, talking about the Knauf-Nesbitt plan, which Knauf-Nesbitt will tell you doesn't exist, which is kind of an interesting way of doing business for the utilities. We would love to see the choice market expanded. We think that competition and additional choices for consumers, customers, is always going to produce the lowest rate and the best service. Whether that's possible to expand that choice marketplace, I think we've seen over the last year, isn't quite the case. So at a bare minimum, we want to protect that 10% choice, and we will continue to our efforts, our grassroots efforts, and our efforts with the legislature to make sure that happens.
What happened with the prevailing wage repeal petitions? Who screwed up on that?
Well, we could sit around and point fingers in terms of what happened, how did things get mixed up. The bottom line is that we have to move forward, and we believe strongly that the repeal of the prevailing wage mandate is an important policy for Michigan, and we're going to be involved with the effort this go-round. We PMT started the circulation of signatures or petitions for signature just this past week, and we intend to be involved with that effort.
Is there anything else being done differently besides hiring a new petition gathering company to avoid whatever mistakes happened before?
I think that in this field and in any field, whenever you have a mix-up or you have a screw-up, you need to learn from that. And so you just pay closer attention. You don't assume things. You take all precautions necessary. And, again, we have hired a different firm, or PMT has hired a different firm, I should say. And we will continue to work with that firm to make sure that they're following the law.
Are you guys going to take any action, or do you know of any action that's going to be taken against the former petition gatherers for the crappy work they did?
I think those types of things, there's always those types of discussions, but I think what we should be focusing on and what we're focused on at the Freedom Fund is working with PMT to make sure that it gets done correctly this time around and that we get this language to the legislature for an up or down vote.
What are the chances of prevailing wage being repealed this year in your mind?
Well, I would, I don't think the Freedom Fund would be involved in the effort if we didn't think that there was a high likelihood of that. But again, that takes a lot of work with the legislature to make sure that they understand the policy and the need for that policy. And as the Freedom Fund will be advocating, it's important for local taxpayers. We think that the money should be used on services or teachers or classrooms or just being in the pockets of taxpayers. It's a mandate that artificially inflates the cost of building government buildings, of schools and township halls, and I can't think of any reason that anybody would support taking additional funds from taxpayers when it's not absolutely necessary.
Are you guys concerned at all about the issues with Flint and Detroit Public Schools maybe sucking the oxygen out of the room in the legislature? So things like electric choice and prevailing wage, it kind of bumped down the priority list?
There's always that chance that the legislature focuses on one issue or two issues. But we have great faith in the legislature and in the governor's office to do the job that they were elected to do, and that's focus on any number of priorities that are before them, whether that be electric choice, whether that be the repeal of prevailing wage, dealing with the Flint crisis. We are focused on our issues and working with the legislature on them, and we intend to keep them focused on those issues.
All right. Well, that's going to do it. Thanks a lot, Tony Daunt from the Freedom Fund. Appreciate you coming in for the podcast this week.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
All right. That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Tony Daunt and the crew here. This is obviously David Bowie, Space Oddity. It's really the only David Bowie song I really can say I like.
Oh, wow. Whoa.
Yeah, I know.
Whoa.
It is.
Whoa.
No, it's
what
not.
About Changes? You don't like the song Changes?
No.
I mean, Under Pressure?
Well, Under Pressure was done with Queen, so yeah, I like that one.
Okay. Well, that counts.
Criticize the man's yeah. entire body work today every day.
Yeah,
oh,
he's...
We're playing Space Oddity. I like the song.
Okay.
Right.
As long as you like...
I enjoy his creativity.
As long as you like one song. But yes, it is a very sad day for music fans everywhere, with the exception of Kyle.
Wait a minute. No, I'm not cheering over here. I don't want to see anybody dead. Come on now. All right, so what should we be playing? Are you going to be playing the Spotify David Bowie channel all day? Is that what you're saying?
All day. You know, with the exception of when I have to go to a meeting here in a few minutes. You know, it'll be a David Bowie day for sure.
Okay, are you guys objecting to this?
No.
Great. Are you okay with this?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's great.
No, nobody's vetoing? Okay, Lauren, you win. Lauren wins. All right.
R.I.P. David Bowie. R.I.P. We'll miss you.
You can quit listening now to the podcast and turn into that David Bowie Spotify channel. Enjoy that and remember him. Until next week, I'm Kyle Blinn. Take care.